This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And that's me just blown into the station. I know. Good grief. What's happening out there? Rusty was saying, surprise, we're still on the air. That just shows what a strong tower we have built up there on Carter Mountain. Thanks to our listeners. That's right. 91.9. As well as those at Crozet and the Valley's 101.1. You know, we're going to talk about poverty today. You know, we talked about homelessness, I think, 2 weeks ago. Poverty, a little different. And we're bringing this about because of this really cool, what I thought to be cool, simulation that's going to be going on in just a couple weeks here in town. And we're going to find out a little bit more about how it takes place and whether or not there's any more slots for people to step up and be a part of it. And we'll find out about that. Let's introduce our guests today. We'll go this way across the room. Test out my pronunciation as we go across. We have over closest to the door, most likely to escape, Susan Goins Epley. She's a nurse, bilingual, community health nurse for the Jefferson area CHIP. What does CHIP stand for?
Children's Health Improvement Program.
Children's Health Improvement Program.
Correct.
Briefly, why do children need health improvement?
Well, this is actually the local, we cover Charlottesville, Albemarle, Fluvanna, and Louisa, but this is a state-level program with the mission of making sure that our youngest children and pregnant women get access to care, get all the healthcare needs that they have met, things like immunizations, prenatal care, all of that, as well as we work with family support workers who work on the education piece so that we're getting kids ready to go to school successful and with their needs met.
And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Also, next in the room, Alicia Lenahan. We had to block her in a little bit. There was some conversation about different panic attacks. Hopefully that doesn't bring it up. About concern. She is the president of Piedmont CASA. That's the court-appointed special advocates. You can find them at www.pcasa.org. The group that's sort of putting on the poverty simulation, correct?
We are. And just to give people a little bit of background, Piedmont CASA has been in existence in the area for 20 years. We serve Charlottesville, Albemarle, Louisa, and Greene counties. We recruit, screen, train, supervise, and support community volunteers who are appointed by juvenile court judges to advocate for abused and neglected kids.
And thank you for having the wind lead you this direction.
Happy to be here.
And tucked over in the corner, I guess because you knew that it was safe. You've been here once before.
It's the window seat.
That's right, the window seat. Ridge Schuyler, he's the director of Charlottesville Works Initiative. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Charlottesville Works Initiative.
It is an affiliate, a nonprofit affiliate of the Greater Charlottesville Area Chamber of Commerce, and it was actually established in 1979 with a mission to reduce unemployment and underemployment and eliminate poverty. And it had the nonprofit had kind of been in and out of existence since 1979. And in 2011, I picked it up and said, let's really do something with this and get some actions on the ground that would actually meet that mission.
So here we are. We'll be talking with our three guests today, Susan, Alicia, and Ridge, about poverty, about the simulation, which is sort of what got us together today. About the three organizations. So sit tight, let the wind keep you in your seat. Stay excited about what's happening. So, but poverty is sort of what ties these groups together. And, first thing I saw, I'm putting my notes together and writing down what the, who the guests are and sort of You know, what are the what are your you know, what are your titles? And I see Susan Goins Epley, bilingual. Is that important when you start talking about poverty?
Absolutely. CHIP works with a number of the folks that you would probably find hidden in Albemarle County. I will often have nursing students or medical students ride with me, and we'll go to homes such as in Southwood Trailer Park, where most of the people who live there speak Spanish. And they will say, I've been in Charlottesville for 4 years and never knew that this part of Albemarle County even existed. So it's very important to be able to work with people in a language that they understand, and be able to help advocate for them so that they can reach out for services that can help themselves and help their children to be successful.
And that is now for medical issues. I can understand that. If you are trying to explain, you know, what's hurting you, mm-hmm. you need a nurse or a doctor who can understand your language other than just. And folks, I always say something that is politically incorrect when we start talking about this. Forgive me. When you just start pointing to the elbow and saying and trying to say that that hurts without being definitive enough, or the person who's understanding that it's not just that it hurts as a bruise, but that it hurts when you are using it as a joint. But how is that different from poverty, from being poor, other than just communication in the language?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, it actually, and I was sitting here thinking, you're right. There's one thing about interpretation and being specific and getting good medical care. But what we have to do is go back a little bit farther for our folks who are from other cultures, other countries, and not just Spanish-speaking families, but refugee families who may be from Nepal or Liberia or, you know, all over the world who live in our community who are trying to get their feet underneath them. They have no idea where they're even supposed to go when their elbow hurts. And so a lot of times those folks are going to end up in the emergency room. And the folks in the emergency room are outstanding if you've been shot or if you've been in a car accident, but they're not going to be particularly good with elbow pain. So we start at the very beginning with our folks who need interpreting, not just language-wise, but just system-wise. Where do you go to get a doctor? And how do you get insurance, if you can purchase insurance, but if not, how do you access the free clinic, or how do you do financial screening at UVA and establish a medical home, which reduces the cost of medical care for everybody, because we don't need to be using the emergency room for those things. We need to be using our primary care doctors.
But that's what takes me back to the question of, is that, how does that play with poverty? And maybe you answered the question and I didn't understand it. There's one thing to be where the two people, the patient and the medical care provider, don't speak the same language, are unable to communicate. But where does poverty play into that?
You're right. I haven't been actually answering your question, and it's a great question. Healthcare has everything to do with poverty. If your elbow hurts and you can't lay brick and that's your job, then you can't work and you don't have an income and you don't have the resources that you need. And so healthcare has everything to do with poverty. Being healthy has everything to do with being able to address the issues that people in poverty face.
Now I feel like I've learned that. So let me step over here to Alicia. Alicia Linehan, who's the president at Piedmont CASA. So Piedmont CASA is a court-appointed special advocate.
Yes.
So where does poverty come into that? Where does poverty come into the courtroom?
Well, it's important to note that poverty is not in and of itself the heart of abuse and neglect. But it is a terrible stressor with our families. So if you are someone who has come from a multi-generational experience of abuse and neglect, if someone in the family has an untreated mental illness, is perhaps struggling with substance abuse, if there's domestic violence, and all of that is compounded by poverty, then it plays a part in almost all of our cases. 98% of our kids come from homes that live well below the poverty line.
I saw somewhere in doing my homework, I'd love to be able to say that, I was doing my homework for the show. Most children served by CASA are from households surviving 300% below the poverty line.
Yes.
I can't even do the reverse math in my head. I come up with, if the poverty line for a family of four, two adults, two kids, is like $24,000. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So the reverse math, I get to $8,000, but I know that that's not right. Is it?
It's close. It's close. Many of our kids come from homes where neither parent is able or willing to work. Or if one of them is working, it is a minimum wage job or multiple minimum wage jobs, just trying to keep body and soul together.
Again, we are talking about poverty today. Our guest, that's Alicia Linehan, the president of Piedmont CASA, court-appointed special advocates. We've also heard from Susan Goings Epley. She's a nurse for Jefferson Area CHIP, Children's Health Improvement Program. We also have Ridge Schuyler with us, who's director at Charlottesville Works Initiative. Ridge, how does that organization work with these two in terms of poverty?
Right. Well, what I'd like to do is step back and say and kind of answer the question that seems to be threading through here, which is, why are we concerned about poverty? What is it about poverty that makes us all come together and do what we do? And I would suggest that if you are low income, if you do not earn enough to meet your basic needs, then you cannot realize your potential as a person. And what we're trying to do is figure out, how do we unleash the potential and the promise of every single person in our community? And when you cannot afford enough to meet your basic needs, it's very hard for you to set aside that stress when you're dealing with your children, set aside that stress when you're thinking about health care. In fact, there's a lot of studies that say that being low income has health consequences, because the constant strain of not having enough money to pay for food or shelter or clothing or utilities has health consequences to your person. So we're interested in alleviating poverty, because we're trying to unleash the potential of every single human being in our community. And so that's why we're interested in it. What we need to do about it is, it's pretty plain. The solution to poverty is money. The way to get money is through decent work. And when I say decent work, I use that specifically, because a minimum wage job in this country pays $14,000 a year. Yet our own analysis of what it costs to live in Charlottesville says that for a mom and two children, in order to survive, to pay their basic needs of food, shelter, clothing, and utilities, that mom with two kids needs to earn $24,000 a year. But in order to earn that money, she's got to work. And she gets added expenses of working, which is transportation and child care. So she needs to earn $34,000 a year in order to make ends meet, to just meet the basic needs of herself and her family. That's $17.50 an hour. And we've done a little bit of analysis in Charlottesville and found that 24% of Charlottesville's families do not earn enough money to pay their basic needs. So that's just – it's not just a few people living over at Southwood.
Right.
It is a fairly extensive problem, not just in Charlottesville but also in Albemarle, where in Charlottesville 24% of our families don't earn enough to meet their basic needs.
We've done topics on this program. We had a – economics professor come in and we talked about minimum wage, and would raising the minimum wage hurt or help the economy, both nationally, specific to this area. I'd like to ask the three of you, would raising the minimum wage solve the problem? Because of course there's the reply from different folks is that yes, the take-home income would go up, and then others who say that the take-home income would go up for person A and person B would lose their job, and so then their income would go down. So would raising the minimum wage solve the problem?
I'll start because I probably have the most negative answer. Our kids come to the attention of the Department of Social Services and the court because their parents are unable or unwilling to keep them safe. And that happens for a whole host of reasons. And as I said, poverty is seldom the presenting issue in terms of what really is going wrong with the family, but it may be the identifying issue. So a child may come to school in weather like this inappropriately attired, or come back to school on a Monday morning exhausted and hungry because life at home has been chaotic and there hasn't been enough to eat. So adding income might mitigate some of the challenges that they face, but the presenting issues tend to be domestic violence, mental health issues, substance abuse, a generational experience with abuse and neglect, all of which is compounded by poverty.
Anyone else want to take on that question?
You want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first. So I think, you know, there's no question based on my working in the community of Charlottesville that people earning more money is critically important. It's not the answer. I sometimes say, you know, money doesn't buy happiness, but lack of money can certainly buy a lot of unhappiness. And so trying to get people so that they are not faced with the constant stress of whether they're going to have a roof over their head or food in their stomachs or clothes on their backs is critically important. Now, there are two ways that we could go at that income question. One is we could use the blunt instrument, which is the raising the minimum wage to try to move people up, but it does have consequences, as you've suggested. Our approach is a little bit more practical, which is let's look around our community and find those jobs that pay a decent wage. Let's find those jobs that pay $25,000 or more that don't require a college degree and see if we can't place people in those existing jobs. So set aside the big national politics for a second and say, look, we are a very well-to-do community, and the struggle we're having is connecting talented people who are low income with quality jobs which exist in our community but which those people are having a hard time finding. Can we tighten up that pipeline between that talent? Because poverty is a lack of income. It's not a lack of value. People have value. Can we identify that value and then put them into the jobs that already exist in our community that pay a decent wage and set aside the fights for somebody else?
I've got several thoughts rumbling around in my head. So I can't speak as a finance person because that's not my expertise, but I am in people's homes every day who are living in poverty. And so, you know, simply put, when there's more money coming into the house, things do go better. And we're not talking about a lot of money. And when we get to talking more about the simulation, I know we're going to talk about this because it's extraordinary how people make ends meet with very little money. There are people living on $8,000 a year. Maybe, you know, it's more common to get maybe about $1,000 a month. But out of that, they pay their rent, they pay their food, they clothe their children. In some cases, they're sending money to family members or supporting an elderly parent who's ill. So it's pretty extraordinary. Every time that they have a better job or more money, the stress level goes down in the family and everybody's better. So I would say that's kind of simply put. But back to what you were saying about matching the people with the jobs. In many ways, I feel like that's kind of what CHIP's doing, but we're starting 18 years early. We're starting with families, and we're trying to put in place healthy homes so that children are healthy. They're getting their immunizations. They're going to the doctor. They're going to school well-fed. And if they have any developmental issues, that we're addressing those early so they don't show up in preschool or in kindergarten not speaking well or having some sort of limitation with their fine motor or their gross motor skills. We address those early before they even get to school. So when they start kindergarten, they start, you know, up with everybody else, and then they soar. And if they start better in kindergarten, then when they graduate from high school, they're going to be better able to fill those jobs.
Right. And I think that there is no question that both our experience, our intuition, as well as the research suggests that you need a if you're going to solve the issue of poverty or at least make a big dent in it, you have to have a two-generation strategy. Somebody's got to be working with the kids to make sure they get a boost at the start of their life, and somebody's got to be working with their parents because the research suggests that almost half of kids born into poverty will become adults in poverty.
Right.
And so we've got to start working with the parents and finding them decent jobs while we're simultaneously working with their kids to get them a quality start in life. And it seems to me that we are a community that can do both and should do both, and we are doing both.
Well, a plug for our organization is that's what's so exciting about the work we do. We have nurses and we have family support workers. As a nurse, it is thrilling to me that when I am working with a family and we're talking about nutrition and we're trying to give them better nutrition, which does cost more, you know, you're going to find in your poverty simulation that macaroni and cheese is a really cheap meal, but it is not a healthy meal. So I have a family support worker that we work side by side. And so that family support worker is making sure that they have the resources to buy the healthy food that we're talking about. Or if the doctor has a prescription for this medication or for exercise or this, that we are putting into place the resources they need in order to be able to even fulfill those. So they do, they go hand in hand. So we're working with the whole family.
And let me just put a fine point on that about how we all work together. The dream of the Charlottesville Works Initiative is that when I find the jobs that pay $25,000 or more that don't require a college degree, that are available, open and real, they're real jobs. They're not abstract jobs. They're real jobs. I take that job information. I give it to the family support worker who's working with Chip. And that family support worker can think, now, which of my parents that I'm working with would be great at that job? And once we've identified that parent that'd be great at that job, then we need to let them travel the pathway to get them from where they are to that job. So we help them get skills and childcare and transportation and healthcare, all of the things which many of us take for granted, but which are essential for someone to be a quality worker. They have to have their childcare lined up and reliable, transportation lined up and reliable. They've got to have the skills that are necessary. But we can create that pipeline from that mom in that house who's been identified by the family support worker to the employer in our community who needs that quality employee and is having a hard time finding them. We can make that work in our community. We're small enough to make it work.
That's right.
Amazing. I feel like I can't catch my breath from all the stuff that's going on here and everything that I'm learning. My brain is starting to smoke. 1121 here at WNRN. And we're talking about poverty. We're going to come back and talk about the poverty simulation with our guest today, Susan Goins-Eppley. She's a health nurse at Jefferson Area Children's Health Improvement Program. Ridge Schuyler, he's the director at the Charlottesville Works Initiative. And Alicia Linehan, she's the president at the Piedmont CASA, who's putting together the Community Action Poverty Simulation, which we'll tell you all about in just a moment.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by the American Civil War Museum, commemorating the 150th anniversary of the fall of Richmond and the surrender at Appomattox, at locations in both Richmond and Appomattox, April 2nd through 12th.
T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing. T&N Printing can be reached at t-nprinting.com.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for being here with us today. We are talking about poverty. We're going to be talking about the poverty simulation. Our guests today, Susan Goins-Eppley, Ridge Schuyler, and Alicia Linehan. Ms. Linehan, the president at Piedmont CASA, who's putting on this Community Action Poverty Simulation. So, you know, I've hinted on that. WNRN's talked about that since Wednesday or Thursday, telling people about what's coming up. And it's coming up on next Saturday, right? Or this upcoming Saturday, February 21st. And I guess if we say the poverty simulation, Yeah, well, I can kind of figure out what that's about. But I'd like a little more detail.
Okay.
So I'd like to know the when, where, how, and why. So let's start with the why.
Okay. Well, as I said, the vast majority of our kids and their families are living in poverty. And they...
Right, so you say the vast majority of our kids and families.
And I mean, by that, I mean Piedmont CASA's kids and families. Right, so kids who are DSS and court involved.
What is the, what percentage of the Charlottesville-Albemarle or the region that Piedmont CASA covers?
Well, we cover Charlottesville, Albemarle, Louisa, and Greene counties. And at this point, with Charlottesville and Albemarle, 100% of the cases that have underlying allegations of abuse and neglect are referred to our program. Last year, 121 volunteers served 234 boys and girls. About 63 kids went through the system or are navigating the system without a volunteer because we didn't have enough volunteers to assign to cases.
Do we know what percentage of children in our in that region area, and anybody can speak up in case Alicia starts looking to you for for statistics, what percentage of these families slash children are truly in poverty?
Well, we've done that analysis for a variety of reasons, but as I said at the outset, 98% of our kids live at or below the poverty line, and of those, the vast majority are 300% below the poverty line.
All right, so we're going to have a simulation this coming Saturday the 21st.
Yes.
And the why is because...
Well, our families are a microcosm of the larger community, and as both Susan and Ridge have pointed out, it's a wonderful place to live and work, but you can drive from point A to point B in Charlottesville without realizing that there are a lot of families who struggle every day to meet their basic needs. And as a result, those families are often judged by the systems that are there to protect and support them. We live in a society that prides itself on the bootstrap mentality. If you work hard enough, you can accomplish whatever you want. And the reverse of that is, if you are poor, you are not working hard enough. And what we hope to share with the simulation is that it is honestly hard work for a family, for a member of the working class, or for families who aspire to be in the working class to meet their everyday needs. So that's food, clothing, shelter, and that doesn't even take into consideration education and medical needs, which both are equally important.
Right, because if you start thinking about food, shelter, and clothing, if you don't have those, then medical needs start filling in and taking up a chunk of your money very quickly.
Yes. Exactly.
All right, so we know why. Give me a quick run on how this is going to work. Go ahead. How is this? And it's a simulation. I so much want to call it a game, but that's not really what it is. I mean, that's not how it's meant to be played out.
Exactly. And even though people will be given roles and identities, and they will be given game pieces, if you will, to help shape the experience, it is a very serious and illuminating educational opportunity. So 80 participants will be broken randomly into family groups of varying sizes with a variety of resources. They will be assisted through this experience with resource volunteers who will be stationed around the room. Those include social workers, the bank, employer, pawn shop, payday lender, the homeless shelter.
Pawn shop.
Got to have a pawn shop. Absolutely. And that's just a short list of who will be helping. The experience is broken down. It's a month in poverty. You live for a month in poverty, broken down into 4 weeks, and each week takes 15 minutes. You and your family have your scenario. These are the cards you've been dealt, And what you have to do is keep a roof over your head and get your bills paid. And it requires people to navigate all of those systems while taking into consideration their individual needs, the need to have transportation to get from point A to point B, and the accessibility of the services that they need. So for every trip out of the home to any of the service providers, you have to have a transportation card, which means that people have to acknowledge that there is an investment of resources to get wherever you're going, even if it's walking. But if you consider transportation in Charlottesville, walking from home to an employer may not be viable. Public transportation is limited. So it really makes you stop and think how hard it is for people to get to work, get to the bank, get to the store. There's a grocery store involved. And if it takes multiple trips to each of those to get your needs met, you just keep subtracting from what you have without adding to what you need to survive.
So how many participants?
80.
And this is this coming Saturday?
Yes.
Are all the participant slots filled?
We have, at last count, 6 openings remaining.
And what does it cost to participate?
It does not cost anything to participate.
I mean, you don't have to make a donation to Piedmont CASA to participate.
No, you don't.
Do you have any, for lack of a better word, celebrities?
Any celebrities?
Well, I mean, and for celebrities, I mean, is David Toscano coming into play?
We don't have any.
Is the guy who does the weather on Channel 29? I don't get Channel 29 anymore. But is the guy who does the weather coming into play? Is, you know, anybody like that? Local, you know, local celebrities. I don't mean is, you know, some movie star coming into play. I don't mean that kind of celebrity.
No celebrities come immediately.
I hear Alicia Linehan's going
to
be there.
I'll be there. But yeah, there you go.
And are you going?
I'm not usually caught off guard with kids. I don't know.
You're a celebrity.
I'm very interested in this. I have to say, I'm very interested in this. I'm aware of the difficulty that gets, and I say this, and because it hasn't been that long ago that I had a medical issue come up that prevented me from driving, and I live in the woods in the county, and being dependent on other people to get you to work, home from work, to the grocery store, to the radio station is not just difficult, but demeaning and financially difficult. And, you know, it's, and so to have to do it for yourself, for family members, which takes away where you have to wipe away the demeaning part of it, because it's just a requirement. You lose the ego part of it because it's part of life. And, you know, suck it up, bad boy, because if you don't do it, then the family doesn't eat or you don't get to work. So it interests me from that aspect. So,
because yours was time limited.
Yes.
As opposed to a way of life.
That's right. I knew when the end date was coming.
It's still hard. I mean, it's hard to go through a time like that.
Yes, it was. But it interests me to do this because I'm fascinated. I'm interested in it. And right. So I will be looking into it.
Okay. And you know, and as you've described, not only is it demeaning to be so dependent on other people, you know, you're not self-sufficient. You're dependent on other people for your ride, in your case, or for help. And where that interests me is that stress and that feeling of not being independent ends up crushing other parts of your potential. It's hard to be the person you can be realize your full potential as a person if you're constantly worried about how you're going to get a ride to work and who's going to pick you up and are they dependable and is their car dependable. And we have to figure out a way to get people past that. But when you are without resources, it is very difficult for you to overcome some of these obstacles. And I'll give you a very real example. We are working with somebody who had a temporary job at the University of Virginia Hospital trying to make a better life for himself. And he was working with us to become a bus driver for Charlottesville Area Transit. He was an immigrant. He is an immigrant from Liberia. He had the stress of his family back home suffering from the possibility of Ebola that was constantly on his mind. He was trying to raise four children, and he wanted to make a better life in America for himself. He almost got kicked out of the program because he could not afford the glasses that were necessary for him to pass the eye test so he could get his commercial driver's license and go from making the wage he was making to making $30,000 a year, which would really put him on a trajectory to success. He didn't have the money for the glasses. And if it hadn't been for us stepping in and saying, we can take you to the 1 hour glasses place because you have to have them by tomorrow, if it hadn't been for us, he would have just fallen by the wayside and been another example of somebody who just couldn't get where they wanted to go, even though there was an opportunity right in front of him, because he didn't have the resources to take advantage of the opportunity.
Another thing that the simulation may make much more real for participants is how close to the edge these families are living. So you may have it all figured out so that you know how you can get to work and you know how your kids are getting to daycare and school and you're cutting it close, but you have it figured out. And then something happens, and maybe it's that sore elbow. Maybe your car isn't reliable and now it's broken down. You can't get to work, so you don't have the resources to get it fixed, but you live out in the woods, so getting to public transportation isn't an option. It doesn't take much to tip everything out of balance and then put a family gravely at risk.
And to give you an idea of the scope of this, I mean, there are 1,000 families living in Charlottesville, Albemarle. These are families. 1,000 families that make less than $10,000 a year. So I don't even know how they do it, living on the edge. The slightest push knocks them back, and then getting to that goal of moving themselves up is unattainable. And getting glasses is just one example of that.
Mm-hmm. And, I don't want to make Charlottesville Albemarle sound as though we don't help others, because we have Jaunt that will drive you to many areas. We have Charlottesville Albemarle Transit, but those aren't always efficient. If you're dependent on someone else whose car goes down, like was said, it's just difficult to be dependent on others, whether it's the bus, whether it's Jaunt and their transportation. It's just difficult, and that's why I'm interested to see what the simulation actually is like, when I feel like I've only had to deal with a very, very, very tiny part of this. So again, Saturday the 21st, we'll toss out the information about this a little later in the program, but the when and where and the time.
Charlottesville High School. You have to register in advance, so go to pcasa.org and push the poverty simulation button and you'll be on your way. Participants will be asked to arrive at 9:15. They'll get registered. We'll be serving a light breakfast. At that point, they'll be given their identity. If you come as a group, you will not serve as a group. You'll be broken up so that everybody is on level footing in that regard. Once everybody is settled in their family groups, then they'll be given their packets so that they have a few minutes to figure out what their storyline is and what the instructions are for the simulation, and then week one will begin.
And just because people are going to ask, including myself, what's the length of time that it's going to start? I mean, you said, I know that the simulation is 15 minutes represents a week, but if I arrive at 9:15...
The simulation itself will start at 10, And we will be done, because there are short breaks in between each week, we'll be done with the simulation about 11:15. We'll be serving, there'll be debriefs, so a small group debrief so that people can get together and talk about their experience. And then there will be a large group debrief, which allows those who are comfortable speaking in a large group to share their thoughts and their observations. That will be followed by a box lunch. And then we'll close the day with Angela Cialfi from Legal Aid Society, who's the director of the Just Children Project, who will talk about poverty in Charlottesville in the context of kids and families.
That's fascinating. 11:39 here on the Wake Up Call. We've been talking about the upcoming community action poverty simulation. We'll continue talking about poverty and the simulation in just a few minutes. Our guest today, Alicia Linehan, she's the president at Piedmont CASA. We also have Susan Goins Epley from she's a health nurse at Jefferson Area CHIP, and Ridge Schuyler, director at Charlottesville Works Initiative.
WNRN thanks the following for their support of independent music radio.
Lexington Rockbridge Area Tourism and the City of Buena Vista, promoting the natural wonders, great American heroes, and charming towns of the Rockbridge area. Information at lexingtonvirginia.com and celebratebuenavista.org.
Sprinter Midlothian, Central Virginia's Mercedes-Benz Sprinter commercial van dealer, providing custom van solutions, including 4x4 capability, parts, and maintenance for contractors, hotels, schools, and families. VASprinter.com to learn how Sprinter Midlothian can help power your business's service and transport needs.
Hello, I'm Suzanne Coffey from PACS, Program of Academic Exchange. PACS provides global education and exchange opportunities for students, host families, schools, and communities. Founded in 1990, PACS is a nonprofit educational organization that provides young people from the United States and abroad with opportunities to live with a family in another country and to study and travel abroad. Each year, up to 1,100 high school students participate in international exchange through PACS. You can share America with a high school exchange student from one of 70 countries. You can learn more about being a host family online, PACS.org. I'm Suzanne Coffey, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for being here with us today, 11:42 on the wake-up call, as we talk about poverty and poverty and the poverty simulation that's upcoming next Saturday at Charlottesville High School, 9:15. Is that what you were saying, Alicia?
Participants, after they register, should arrive at 9:15.
Have to go to the PCASA, PCASA.org website. And can you just come and hang out and watch?
Well, you know, I suppose so, but it's going to be pretty chaotic.
I mean, if I show up, can I get groupies to follow me around?
Absolutely. We'll arrange for that specifically for you. I can't guarantee it for everybody else.
All right. Susan, you were talking about making sure that we, that I had dragged us down this this road of the, sadness of poverty, and that there's inspiration out there as well.
Well, we all kind of do that. It's one of those things that I think we do is we look at people and we pity them. And actually, there's nobody that wants to be pitied. We have in our organization the privilege of being invited into people's homes to work with them, with their children, on healthcare and education needs. And all of us who work at CHIP and in organizations like this will tell you that we are inspired every day by what we see about people's resourcefulness, their love for their children, what they want to do to just make their lives and their families' lives better. So I'm excited about the simulation because I think what will happen is people, when they're inhabiting those roles, are going to really be proud of themselves for some of the problem solving they'll be able to accomplish. And also they get to experience the incredible joy that can come from when you get those glasses that are going to make everything else work for the moment. But then the realization that it is moment to moment, but it is, as Alicia said at the very beginning, it's just living with poverty is a real job, that you have to have skills to do. It's skilled work.
And I should make it clear that when I was talking about needing rides because I couldn't drive, I was not suffering from poverty.
Right.
Was far from suffering from poverty. You know, doesn't stop you from whining about your own problems until you put yourself next to someone else and say, oh, I should shut up now.
Well, I saw that a little differently. I think it was an opportunity to sort of open yourself up with some empathy and say, you know, this was hard for me now. I can't imagine what it's like for somebody who has to deal with this every day. I mean, you know, it's our experiences can actually just make us more empathic and more connected to our neighbors instead of separated from them.
And during that last brief break, we were chatting about the different thoughts in our lives about, or how we treat things, change in the coffee mug. Ridge, tell the listeners about that.
So I had one of the participants in our program, and our program is to try to identify those talented people who are being left behind by our economy and connect them to employers who are looking for quality people who have those decent jobs and making that connection very real and very tight. And one of our participants many years ago ran afoul of the law, minor criminal offense, but she needed to report that so that she could get funding to pay for a training program that would get her into a better job. And she finally found her way to the right courthouse, which had a copy of her old criminal record. But she called me and she said, I'm going to have to drop out of your program. And I said, why? She said, well, in order to get the funding to get the training program, I need to show that agency a copy of my criminal record. And it just happens that it runs on 4 pages just the way it prints out. And it's 50 cents a page, so it's $2, and I don't have $2. And so I can't fulfill the requirements, and I'm going to have to drop out of your program. And I said, I've got $2 kicking around in the ashtray in my minivan, because the ashtrays now are used for coins instead of for ashes. I said, I'll be right there. But the absence of that $2 in her mind was the stop, the absolute obstacle that would prevent her from doing better. But we got her the $2. She finished the training program, and now she's in a decent job, and she's incredibly happy, and thereby fulfilling her potential as a person.
We are talking today about poverty and the simulation, which still has some open spots for this coming Saturday. Susan Goins-Epley, she's a bilingual community nurse at Jefferson Area Children's Health Improvement Program. We've also heard from Ridge Schuyler, director at Charlottesville Works Initiative, and Alicia Linehan, she's the president at Piedmont CASA, court-appointed special advocates, www.pcasa.org, where you can go and sign up if you want one of those last spots at the simulation. You know, can anybody tell me, are there any bills being passed around down at the General Assembly that people should know about, that they might still have something they can call up their legislator or and say, please do something about this, or why didn't you do something about that?
I know most of the bills that may impact CASA programs and the families we serve at this point, and there are none that I'm aware of that would address this issue.
Right. I mean, from Seville Works' perspective, what we're trying to do is we're trying to harness what we already have. We're trying to harness what we have in Charlottesville. I mean, you look around Charlottesville, and it does remind me of, you know, when Martin Luther King was standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963, you know, people talk about that as a civil rights march, but it was actually a march for jobs and freedom. That was what it was billed as. And he talked about the sad fact that there were so many people living in lonely islands of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. Well, that is Charlottesville. We have people living in poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. And the challenge we have is, how do we connect that vast ocean of material prosperity, those jobs that pay a decent wage, with the people who are struggling, and make that connection? And it isn't about legislation, and it isn't about policy at this stage, at least from our perspective. It's about harnessing what we already have, rolling up our sleeves and say, how do we go find those individuals who are struggling? Do we connect with the family support workers at CHIP? Or how do we find those folks who are struggling? How do we talk to the employers who have the decent jobs, not the minimum wage jobs, but the ones that are the next tier up, $25,000 or more, that don't require a college degree? How do we make the connection between those two people? Because those two people, that person struggling and that employer, are only two steps removed from each other in Charlottesville. Somebody knows somebody who knows that person. And can we make that connection tight? And we don't have to wait for the General Assembly to act. We just need to figure out, how do we make that work on the ground in real people's lives in Charlottesville? And we're doing it. Slowly, too slowly from my perspective, but we're doing it.
From my perspective, the one that we would make the biggest difference, from what I could see that would be immediate, would be expanding Medicaid. And we come up against that all the time when we go through the process with families who are underemployed, but they are making too much to receive free care, and we don't want them to be receiving, you know, complete care at UVA without, you know, with it totally covered. We'd love to see them insured, and those dollars are there. They're available for us, and it would make such a huge difference across the board for us for Medicaid to be expanded, and we know what to do with it, and we would help people use it efficiently, and it would save us all a lot.
Two-part question here. The percentage of the families in our area that are working under poverty, are they similar to the percentage of what the families are? Are the same percentage of how do I phrase this properly? I'm not even trying to be politically correct. The same percentage of white families in the area, do they make up the same percentage of white families dealing with poverty? The same percentage of Hispanic families in the area, do they make up the same percentage of Hispanic families dealing with poverty, etc.? Do we know that?
I have no idea how to answer that question.
So I don't tend to look – I tend to look at, you know, who are the struggling families, and I don't really I don't, you know, look at them in terms of racial or cultural makeup. I look at how many families in Charlottesville are struggling, and Charlottesville Albemarle. I mean, I said it at the beginning of the program. I'll reiterate it because it is kind of shocking that 24% of the families living in Charlottesville do not earn enough to be self-sufficient. And the vast majority of those are working families. They're not people who are not working. They are families who are working but cannot earn enough to meet their basic needs. And we need to figure out a way to raise them to the first rung of a middle class income that lets them move up and lets their children move up. And again, I don't look at it. When I started looking at this issue in 2011, I was shocked. In 2011, of course, the economy was worse. But back then, it was 29% of Charlottesville's families did not earn enough to be self-sufficient. And if you look at Charlottesville as a whole, pull the lens way back, you know, when you say you're doing anti-poverty work in Charlottesville, people look at you like you're crazy, because the median family income in Charlottesville is $63,000 a year. That means that, you know, that you look at that, you say that's a pretty healthy community. But if you look down into the neighborhoods, we have two neighborhoods literally across the railroad tracks from each other. Isn't that always how it happens? Where in one neighborhood, the median family income, that means more people, you know, half the people make above this and half make below, the median family income is $90,000 a year. And right next door, the median family income is $22,000 a year. So that means that half the families in the neighborhood make less than $22,000 a year. They're working, but they're likely working in minimum wage jobs full time. They're working 40 hours a week. They're doing what our society asks them to do, which is to work really hard, but they're not getting anywhere because they don't make enough money.
Well, I asked that question because what I wanted to know was, are the same percentage of families who are dealing with poverty also reaching out and either asking for or receiving help?
So if I could just – one of the things that we're trying to do with the Charlottesville Works Initiative, which is a little bit different than the way the world has worked historically, is the way the world has worked historically is from workforce development – we had a process called train and pray. We train people and then pray they can find some kind of job out there. We use a very broadcast method, both employers trying to find employees, broadcasting out to, you know, the world through a website, or employees, potential employees, just blasting out their email in a broadcast method to whoever will accept their resume. We are saying we need a much more intentional process. We need a way of finding those struggling families. How do we find them? Well, we find them because there are people who work every day with those struggling families, whether they're at Piedmont CASA or whether they're at a Jefferson Area CHIP, whether they're guidance counselors at school, or whether they're just people in the community who know everybody. Those socially well-connected people who they may be somebody in a church or in an immigrant community who just know everybody. And one of the things that we're experimenting with in the Charlottesville Works Initiative is identifying those people at the middle of their social networks and saying, what if we fed them job information? What if we sent them, here are the jobs that are available that pay $25,000 or $30,000 or more that don't require a college degree, like that bus driver job, like a CNA job at the University of Virginia Hospital. What if we took that job information and said, you know what, instead of just throwing it out there and hoping that people can find it, what if we give that information to the people who are socially well-connected or working on the front lines with struggling people and had them think, who do I know that would be really good at that? And then grab that person by the lapels and say, are you interested in becoming a bus driver? Because, you know, you could make $30,000 a year. It's a $15 an hour job. And then that person says, golly day, yes, I'd love to do that. Then we have to figure out, okay, how do we get you, immigrant from Liberia who wants to be a bus driver for Charlottesville Area Transit, how do we get you from where you are to that job? How do we make sure that you have the skills you need, like that commercial driver's license, the child care you need because you've got a toddler who's 2 years old that we want to put in quality child care so she has a good boost on the beginning of her life? How do we make sure you have the transportation to get to Charlottesville Area Transit? We've got to be intentional about finding that person, about getting them the things they need in order to be a quality employee, and then presenting them to the employer who is desperate to find that quality employee but is having a hard time doing it because they're using a broadcast rather than intentional and focused method. That's the system we're trying to build. It is very different than the one we have, but that's how – it's not whether people are reaching out and asking for help. It's can we find the job and give that information directly to the people who are struggling.
I think kind of bringing this back to the simulation a little bit, I think the folks that participate are going to discover a lot of things. And one of the things, that they're going to discover is these resources. Are they getting resources? You can't live on welfare. That's not a way there's not enough there. TANF, which I guess would be the traditional just money that is a time limited, resource, food stamps and WIC, they're not enough to totally feed your family. It's just a supplement. It's just enough to help sometimes. So, and people, nobody really wants to be in that position. It's not fun to have to go in and go through the process in social services to access those resources. That's not something that is a joy to do. And so, you know, I think people get what they can to get through the moment, but that's not their ultimate goal. And so, you know, and another thing that Alicia said that I think was so important is just this discovery of how many people are just living on the edge. They're going to get that one card with that one thing that's going to tip them over. And all of a sudden they were making ends meet and suddenly they're not.
Well, Alicia, the simulation, again, this coming Saturday, the 21st, go online, PCASA, PCASA.org. Sign up ahead of time, 9-ish in the morning, 9 o'clock, 9:15, to show up and do your thing. It takes It's designed to simulate 1 month in poverty. What is the average length of time? How long do people live in poverty?
Well, as Ridge said, and certainly as our families illustrate, it's often multi-generational. Because if there isn't someone in your family who has managed to get from that subsistence living to that first rung of really being in the working class, then it becomes a self-perpetuating cycle. And I, you know, I don't have a number, but I think that, you know, I look to Susan and Ridge and
it's, but you're not talking about 2 years or 5 years or 7 years. You're talking about for the majority of families.
Well, there is a distinction between situational poverty and generational poverty. So situational poverty, and we'll go back to your example of the medical emergency. You know, if there is a medical emergency, you may be tipped over the edge into poverty. And once you have recovered and if you have the necessary resources, you may be able to come back. Divorce can create a situation in which a family is tipped into impoverished circumstances. But in terms of the long-term experiences that I think that we deal with more regularly, it is because no one in the family has successfully bridged that gap.
I had no idea that it's already noon. I've completely lost track of time. I mean, I'm sort of fascinated, but in this sort of weird way, because I want to learn more about it so that I can not be. I don't want to go there. PCASA, PCASA.org. We'll put up the links to the other sites for Jefferson Area CHIP and Charlottesville Works Initiative. Ridge Schuyler, Susan Goins-Epley, Alicia Linehan. Please participate in the poverty simulation. People take up those six open spots. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Les Temps-Perdue up next. Next week, talk about different topics. The Academy Awards will be here. We'll have an unusual crew in to talk about the Academy Awards. Aloha.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong
and Max Cecilia Struther.
Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.